And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. If you're listening to my show, you're looking for tips on how to work smarter, not harder. And let's be real, you're already working hard to earn your money, but how do you make sure that your money is working hard for you? Here's how. With a Betterment automated investment and savings app, your money will go to work. They've got technology that will provide you with advanced tools, and they're built to help maximize your returns, not to mention your time. They have expert-built portfolios of low-cost exchange-traded funds. You know I love those exchange-traded funds. There's automated investing technology, and as part of that, automated rebalancing. Many of you have been asking about rebalancing, and it sort of feels like a hard thing to do on your own. With Betterment, easy peasy. They do it for you. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Learn more about high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank. With Fidelity Wealth Management, a dedicated advisor can work with you on a comprehensive plan to help you reach your wealth's full potential. Plus, you'll have access to specialists in estate planning strategies. So you're not just growing and protecting your wealth, you're sharing it. More at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE SIPC. Welcome to the Jill on Money podcast. It is October 16th. It's the weekend, and we are so happy you are joining us. Today, we are going to talk to somebody whose byline I've been reading for a long time. His name is Robin Wigglesworth. He is the global finance correspondent of the Financial Times. Robin has just written a new book that is So interesting. It is called Trillions, How a Band of Wall Street Renegades Invented the Index Fund and Changed Finance Forever. Now, you guys know I love index funds. So going back into the history of how this started was so illuminating. Robin, who self-describes himself as immensely nerdy, makes this very, very tangible. So here is the first part of our interview with Robin Wigglesworth. I mean, look, you wrote a deep dive, 300-page book about index funds. You must be some sort of, I don't know, maybe you're a glutton, or maybe you just were up constantly because you were having children. What was going on that made you write this book?
Yeah, well, I'm obviously I'm a financial journalist, so I'm immensely nerdy anyway. But for me, you know, it was something I'd written a lot about for the Financial Times, like how this was changing markets. And it was one of those stories. The more I dug into it, and the more I dug into the history of it, the more I realized just how monumental this was, and how it's kind of arguably one of the biggest, least appreciated economic stories of our times. Because here you have this fantastic invention by a bunch of these kind of nobodies, or essentially widely hated by Wall Street, that saved people hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars.
And what's so fascinating is that I think people like me who come from the world of financial planning, investment management, I think that many of us went through a transformation that some of the characters in your book went through, which is you come out of a certain brand of, say, Wall Street, and you say, well, you know, with enough research, you should be able to outperform an index. And we always compare ourselves with the index. And then you get to some moment in your life where you're like, actually, that doesn't work. The idea that you go back to around this is really grounded in research. So first, let's talk about what is this thing called the theory of speculation.
Well, so the theory of speculation was a PhD thesis by Louis Berkelier. And he was born in France. He was supposed to run his parents' vineyard and vintnery when they passed away too early. But he wanted to study in Sorbonne. So after running the family business and going into the French army, he went to the Sorbonne to study mathematics. But he had to work. So he worked at the French Stock Exchange at the time. This was the late 1800s, early 1900s. So he decided to write his PhD thesis on how stock market prices seem to move. And at the time, finance was a little bit grubby, right? Certainly in France. So people thought that this was a fairly unorthodox subject. But the theory of speculation that he wrote is kind of the wellspring from which I argue index funds sprung, because he was the first guy that showed mathematically that actually stock prices seem to move at random. And arguably, you know, for every person that sells a stock, somebody is buying it for the same reason. So arguably at any given time, the market reflects what people think is the fair price. So this was the kernel of efficient markets.
I had always thought that the idea around index funds was sort of like the John Bogle of Vanguard brainchild. So this book was really so fascinating because you go back not just to the early 1900s, but then even in the 20th century after the crash and I guess in the 30s, that there was a lot of research that was being done around whether or not people can predict the performance of a given stock or company. And was that something that you kind of knew, or is that something you stumbled upon in your research?
Well, it was something both, I'd say. I mean, Isaac Newton once said that, you know, if he's seen further, then it's only by standing on the shoulders of giants. And Jack Bogle was undisputably a titan of the financial industry, but he definitely stood on the shoulders of some big giants. And it was a delight peeling back the onion, as it were. The more you further you went back, you realized that people had kind of done some of this work here and there. But this is an era before rigorous data collection, long before the era of computers. It was really only in the 50s and 60s when people could actually calculate this and show it with cold, hard evidence that it really started to sink in, that people could basically show this is how the market does in the long run and this is how well investment managers do in the long run. And you can see there's a bit of a gap there, and that was hard to explain away.
Whenever you had someone who brought this up, it is the person or the research is met with this huge pushback by the industry. Now, is that still going on today? I mean, there are still people, I think, who, if even when I say, well, you know, just buy the index, they'll be like, well, you know what? This person has beaten the market this many times, and or this pension fund has done this many times. And so what is it about these outsiders that allows them to accept the information as presented rather than push back against it?
Well, I think it's a little bit just the fundamental issue that it's hard for incumbents to disrupt themselves. Kodak, you know, did actually invent digital cameras. It did actually have a project on, but it just couldn't, it couldn't push through with this. Blockbusters had online streaming, kind of realized that this could become a thing, but just couldn't adapt or didn't want to adapt. And for Wall Street, you know, this is a product that just is anathema to the whole ethos of Wall Street. I mean, really, the ethos of most people, right? Nobody wants to accept mediocre. I want to be a really good journalist. I want to be better than the next journalist. And that's how kind of humanity almost sort of walks forward. And index funds seems almost contrary to that. It's accepting mediocrity, as the former head of Fidelity once said. You know, who wants to be operated on by a mediocre surgeon? But investment management is one of those few areas of life where, like you say, it actually pays off empirically to be a little bit lazy and just index. And these criticisms come and go and have, yes, like you say, since the dawn of indexing. I mean, since even before the index fund was invented, people were attacking the very idea of it. And I don't think it's ever going to go away. There's always going to be some people that just see this as the enemy and will find something to object against.
So I'm just going to say that for myself, as someone who used to be a money manager, I remember in the 90s, I was managing a bunch of money for clients. And it was true that in the year 1999, early 2000, I sold out a bunch of technology companies and the trade worked. It was great, right? But it did take me too long to get back in. And that was my lesson in that I can't actually time the market. Even if I had the right idea, I would have to execute two sides of this trade perfectly. And that is when I became much more of an adherent to the strategy of indexing. I guess that for me, because I was a money manager and a financial planner, I told myself this story of like, okay, well, if this is mathematically true and I am going to use that, then I can at least do this thing called financial planning. If you are just a straight up money manager, if you believe it's true, then your business is kaput, right?
The mathematics around indexing are irrefutable. I mean, it is, the markets are it's a zero-sum game. And for everybody who does better than the market, you know, somebody has to do worse. For everybody who sold the stock, somebody bought it, and vice versa. So no investment manager will ever argue that side of things. But their argument is that, well, we are obviously better than average, so we can do better in the long run. Like, we might have a year or a month or a quarter or even a couple of years where we do badly, but we're amazing and we can definitely time the market or find the best selection of securities or build the best portfolio. But like you say, I think most investors and most big, really successful investors have some sort of moment where they realize that the market is just immensely difficult and is getting harder to beat consistently. So I tend to think that the best, most consistently successful money managers that I've met and spoken to over the years are actually quite often the people that admit the most willingly the limits to their knowledge and how much stuff they can get wrong. Because frankly, like you said, with markets, you were right to sell tech stocks at that time, but maybe you should have waited another couple of months or bought in. I mean, these are the problems. Like, I have a lot of sympathy for asset managers because that job is just very darn hard. And we kind of need them to make markets, keep them a little bit efficient, but we probably don't need as many as we have around today.
When you hear someone who's running a big endowment, right? Like, remember the David Swensen from the Yale Endowment? He wrote that huge piece about, like, you'll never beat the market because I have access to the best managers and you, the little peons, you have no access to that. Mm. How do you respond to that after doing all the research that you've done?
I kind of think it's true. I tend to say that the one thing that differentiates me a little bit from what I sometimes call the passive jihadists, the full-on efficient market zealots that say that anybody who's ever beaten the market, it is pure luck. Because in the long run, somebody's going to beat the market. Just in the long run, there are very few of them, and you can't identify them before time. I do think there are some people that, through the dint of the teams they've put together, have and probably will consistently beat the markets. But there are very few of them. They have capacity constraints, and they don't rent out their skill very cheaply. So a classic case is Renaissance Technologies, this huge computer-driven hedge fund started by Jim Simons. Their main hedge fund, they have others that investors dabble into, but like the sexiest flagship fund has been closed to anybody but those who work at Renaissance for over a decade now, because they don't, you can't even get access to that. And if you look at all the top hedge funds in the world, you know, that's a Citadel or Millennium, they tend to be closed. They're not taking in new investors. And I think
that. So what is it that makes them able to beat the market? Is it the modeling? Is it the girth of the trade? I mean, what is it that you think can actually allow them to beat the market? And could that possibly be replicated for the masses?
Not for the masses, because fundamentally, as soon as something gets commoditized, it's a commodity. So there's an old quote that one of the pioneers of indexing, Jim Vertin at Wells Fargo, had pinned on his wall. There's none of us is as smart as all of us. And I think the best asset managers, whether it's of classic mutual fund groups like Capital Group, with its American funds or T. Rowe Price or hedge funds, I tend to find that it's people, process and teams. Like, they have good culture and teams that work together, so they all become more than the sum of their parts. And they have good process. So you're not dependent on a single star manager. Because like every era of Wall Street, as you well know, has had one or two managers that just look like absolute rock stars. Everything they touch turns to gold. And then at some point, there's a market break and it all fizzles and it's revealed to be fool's gold, essentially. That they were just riding one particular strategy or trade that did well for a few years, or maybe even 10, 15 years. But inevitably, the ear comes out and they're revealed to be human, very human. That, I think, is the issue. You rely on, if you find a good asset manager with good culture, a good teamwork, and a good process, then I think you probably have a better shot than picking whoever is the hot fad of the day, whether it's like a Jerry Tsai back in the 60s or Bill Miller or Kathy Wood today, for example.
So if you were to give advice to someone who, we actually get this question every so often, like, well, should I put money in Kathy Wood's fund? What's your answer to that? Is there a more mathematical answer to that? Because it does not appear that she has what you just described as essentially alpha, people, process, team. She's making a momentum trade, isn't she?
Kind of, yes. I think so. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. And it is interesting always seeing somebody do something a little bit different. And she's had phenomenal success.
Yeah.
But broadly, yes, every era has had a breakout star like that. And inevitably, they've crumbled. So I'm very wary of giving advice because, frankly, like, I talk to people a zillion times smarter than me all the time. And I see them screw up all the time as well. I quite often end up writing about their screw ups, right? So that's made me very humble about how much I know. And I'm always worried about saying, don't invest in X or invest in Y. And then, you know, 2 days later, 2 years later, somebody comes and complains. But broadly speaking, the only advice I feel very comfortable giving, just because it's backed up by centuries of data across every major market in the world, is that the vast majority of investors should index across the vast majority of the portfolio and just forget about it.
And not sweat it. And you know what else I always try to explain to people is that, you know, your ability to save is probably going to be a bigger determining factor about reaching your goals rather than what you actually invest in once you do save. In other words, even if these are superstar investors and they, you know, they swing big and they make over the course of how many, you know, let's say 30 years of investing, maybe they do deliver a little bit more return. However, your ability to actually save money in your real life and get that money to work is actually probably the one thing you can control. So it is incumbent on people to hear this conversation and not say, oh, you see, all I have to do is index and sit on my ass. It's I actually have to save the money, put it away, and do it over and over and over again, and then I'll stay out of trouble and I should probably reach my goal. It's actually not that complicated. And I think that that's something that people just don't dwell on too much.
Well, I think it was Bogle or Buffett, or maybe both of them, that said, you know, it's a successful investing is a little bit like dieting. Like, it's actually easy. We know what you should do, but it's so hard to do in practice. It does require discipline. And I do think that, like, if you're going to invest with a Kathy Wood or whoever comes next, you know, the key is not performance chasing. If you think she or he, they're onto something, then you need to kind of stick to that. Because, like you say, we know that actually the end result for most investors is even worse than if they're just stuck with a fund manager. The fact that people, you know, chase momentum, we chase hot hands, and then we get out early. Like Kathy Wood, phenomenal returns in 2020, massive inflows at the start of the year, but now the era's come out and she's, you know, billions of dollars have seeped out of her funds. So, you know, what has changed with her process? Absolutely nothing. But why would you invest in her if you didn't believe in the process? So I do think a lot of people could save themselves a lot of grief by, you know, being a little bit more disciplined, whether they choose an active fund or a passive one. Because we do know that, you know, active funds do suffer a lot from money sloshing in and out all the time as well.
I mean, that's just, you know, the emotional, the fear and the greed just kick in. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about DFA, or as my friend in the business likes to call them, the evangelical indexers.
Yes. No, I mean, it's a fascinating outfit. I mean, Rex Sinkfield, one of the founders, even he describes himself as the Ayatollah of efficient markets. Gene Farmer, the famous University of Chicago professor and Nobel laureate, is, I guess, you know, God in the efficient markets pantheon. They're a fascinating shop, and they're not pure indexes in that they don't just buy market cap, cheap, easy sort of Vanguard fund style stuff. They try to sort of lean into certain durable factors, or what people like Gene Farmer have shown to historically be sort of characteristics of certain stocks that tend to do well over the long run. But they definitely have a sort of a whiff of evangelism about them, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I was in the business, the one reason I didn't want to use them, I remember, was that there was this, it was like a lockbox. Like, you're either going to use us for all of your investing or none of it. You cannot go halfway. That's a pretty big ask of someone who's managing money, right? And the other part of it that's hard, and I know that they've changed some around some of their policies, you know, in the next, you know, in the subsequent decades, but what you have to be able to tell the person who's investing, the client, is there's going to be severe underperformance in certain years. You're going to hate me for certain years. And your client will nod their heads and say, yes, of course, I know that. And then that crap year comes and they're like, why is this so bad? Why is this so bad? And you say, well, remember we had that conversation? And they look at you like you've never had the conversation. So it has been a good proof that their model works.
Jack Bogle was really good at this at Vanguard as well. Like whenever like one of their funds or the market had done really well, he'd be the Cassandra that comes in and spoils everybody's mood and saying, well, this can't continue and this is terrible. And actually, I think that's absolutely essential. And I think DFA, you know, for them, it was partially that they started a small caps fund. This was the first ever fund. And the first year, it was great. But then small caps had one of the longest, worst runs that they've had in a century. Mm. So they almost, I mean, I don't think they almost went under, but it was definitely a very tough, lean time for them. And I think that kind of scarred them. And I think that kind of culture of them up front, both warning direct institutional clients, but also indoctrinating financial advisors that want to use dimensional products, that, you know, you need to be fully aware that all strategies have drawdowns that can be long and painful. And yes, I mean, it doesn't make it that much easier to explain to clients, but I do feel that most human beings, when given obvious transparency, when we feel that somebody's being straight and upfront with us, we accept it.
Okay, that was part one of our interview with Robin Wigglesworth, the author of Trillions, all about the sort of the background of the index fund industry. If you've got a financial question, maybe it's about index funds, maybe it's about something else, just give us a holler, hop onto the website, jillonmoney.com, click the contact button, and we'll get your message. Don't forget to tell us if you'd like to come on the air. All right, very good. Do something nice for someone else today. Grit, growth, grace. We'll talk to you tomorrow.